you know, really information.
Took a while. But there was a big thing, and I always mention this because it's two forces in my life which have been the most important forces in my life. Everything had reached the point that I didn't need you people. I didn't need those silly, stupid cheerleaders. And you people were so stupid anyway, I think it or not. And I didn't know it at the time. But indeed, I did progress to be so sick. And I never dreamed that I could do that. There's when nothing much was happening, of course I could grow spiritually and I could grow. And I used to think it's just have power. But it's not have power. It's greater than me. And it's got to be somebody other than me. Jerry back 2 months before he died. And it's an incredible piece of work when you read that piece of paper to see what it was that I was so...
Sober, birthday, a heartbeat at a time. To where it's in Bakersfield, 18 miles or 25 miles, whichever it was, there was a little sign pointed to the right that Arvin. And then there was this guy in the ambulance at first. The first picture showed him in an ambulance, and that was very interesting. I met one of the greatest experiences that I can remember ever having, and I should talk a little bit about it, is that, let me get a bearing on the clock here so that I won't be charged with talking too long. I was the executive secretary of the central office in Los Angeles for 12 years. And I want to tell you that I finally got an apartment four blocks away from the office. And I always loved animals, so I had a little dog, a little fox terrier, Tippy. And I would walk him in the mornings before I went down to the office. And I got an apartment a block away from 1805 Wilshire Boulevard, where the central office was. And I would walk him to a park, which was about four blocks away from the central office, every morning. And so one morning, I took him down, and I was walking around, and there was a tree in the center of the park, and under it was a man with a newspaper. He was sitting down with his feet out. And as the dog and I were walking past him, he would move the newspaper so that we couldn't see him. That was his little home there under the tree, and he just made himself invisible to the lady that walked the dog every morning. And I never got to see what his face looked like. And then one time when I walked the dog at night through the park, and it was safe in those days, he was lying down with a newspaper over his face. And I watched his deterioration. And I felt ashamed. And I thought, here you've become a professional AA answering the telephones at the central office and sending other people out to work with the alcoholics. And yet you've been watching this man now for a week, and here he is on the ground. And I took the dog home and then walked back. And looked under the tree. It must have been a willow tree of some kind. It came down almost to the ground all the way around. And I looked under there, and he was stretched out straight and not moving. And I thought, oh, I've waited too long. He's dead. I've waited too long. And so I bent over him, and I hollered, Mister! No answer. Mister! No answer. And I never could arouse him. And I thought, I've waited. Oh, I'm a rotten person. So I went to the corner liquor store, and I got a scrap of paper and asked him for a pencil and a pen or something, a scotch tape. And I wrote a little note, and I said, I'll be back at 6 a.m. in the morning to see you. Stay where you are at all costs. And I somehow pinned it to his shirt and went on home. And so the next morning, I left the dog at home, and I went back to see the man, and I tiptoed under the tree, and he was propped up under it, and he said, old lady, I woke up, when I came home last night, I found your little note and was laying on the ground. I guess you thought you had put it on my body, but I thought it was a note of some kind, but my glasses, I usually hang them up on the tree at night when I come home. I've been staying here a long time, but they're not there now, so I couldn't read it. So I took it to the liquor store, and the man said, you get back under that tree and you stay there till that lady comes back. So he says, now you got me, lady. What are you going to do with me? And I said, you'll see. So I put him in the car, and I took him down to the 12-step house, and I told him to look after him, and which they did. And so pretty soon, one morning, he comes into the central office where I'm working. It wasn't long after that either, and he looked. I didn't recognize the man. They'd given him clothes. And he said, little lady, he says, you know, I'm kind of deaf, and that's why I couldn't hear you very well that night when you tried to talk to me under the tree. And he says, I'm awful hard of hearing. And he said, one of the members down there at the 12-step house, his wife had died, and he gave me a hearing aid. I can hear now. I can hear you if you want to talk to me. And he said, you know, they made me cook down there at that 12-step house. And I was, that was my profession. I was a cook before my drinking got so bad. So he said, I don't plan on drinking anymore. And I go to the meetings around the area here, and especially at the 12-step house. So I don't intend to drink. And he said, I want to give you a buck for you to put in the kitty here for somebody like me that might come along and need help as bad as I did that night. And so he said, I'll come back and see you pretty often. It's only about 4 or 5 blocks from here, which he did. And he never had another drink. He looked sharp in a $50 suit long after that. I kept track of him forever and a day. And it made me feel good to see what would be considered a helpless, hopeless person in every aspect turn out just to be a solid citizen. And then one time, I was sitting there at the central office answering the phone, and a girl's voice said, can you help me? And I said, that's what we're here for. And she began to cry. And she said, I don't know what to do. I'm sitting down here in this Skid Row hotel room, and there's about 11 winos lined up against the wall asleep, and their drugs are all over the floor. And I'm so hungover and sick, and I just don't know what to do. And I said, well, we can't help 11 winos passed out down on Skid Row. She said, well, I know that, but what about me? What about me? Can you help me? And I said, well, of course, that's a different story, but I won't send a woman down there alone. I said, will you not drink until I can get someone down there? It might be several hours. I'll get on the phones right away, which I did. And I got Bill Welch and his wife, who were both AA members, and they went down there on Skid Row and found the exact situation the way it was. And I called up B at the Friendly House and told her that this gal begged for help, that she was a helpless Skid Row wino, and would she take her in? And B said, send her over to me, baby, send her over to me. And then I called Happy Austin, who was a go-getter, and I said, can you round up some clothes for a gal who wants to get sober and not what she doesn't want to drink? Happy said, you can count on me. And it just turned out fine. Well, the thing was that her husband and son and this woman had all got separated because of her boozing. And her husband had been an upstanding citizen, and her son was in a home somewhere out in El Monte, and she didn't know how to find him. And anyway, B investigated around and found out where the ex-husband was. And so this girl developed pneumonia, and it was Christmas time, and she developed some kind of pneumonia that drugs get, and she died. And it was my job then to notify the son and the husband. And they came, but they didn't know. The son was never told that his mother was in that shape. It was just that she lived there with those beautiful women at Friendly House and had been doing fine when she caught pneumonia. And he never knew. He was just a fine-looking boy, about 15. And so Happy Austin called every woman alcoholic she could lay hands on to be there to make a funeral out of it. And when we got out there, I want to tell you, there was a crowd of people, men and women.
There's one lady on the west
end around there making out that they were friends of this woman who died so suddenly. And that made you feel good when you saw that boy later on and he grew up. He never knew that his mother had this terrible problem. And it didn't hurt him not to know at that particular time. If he was told later when he was a man, why, I'm sure he took it very well indeed. But this alcoholism thing is such a killer. And it is so hard to peg. And there's not too many people who really understand what it's all about. Our neighbors down the street certainly don't. Maybe they think they do now because they've been enlightened and they've read a lot. But they never know until they themselves, if they're alcoholic and want help and need help, and when they recognize that and come here and find the welcome that this man of 25 days will find that he has, what a wonderful big family it is. It's just like one big family. I'm not afraid of you anymore. I don't feel like I don't belong. I feel like I'm at home. I would be at home anywhere, in any land. Whether they could speak English or not, it wouldn't make any difference. Honest to goodness, Bob went up to Inuvik in Northwest Territories to talk a few years back because they had nothing up there but igloos. And they said, when they phoned him and told him to come, they said, you being civil, and we'll make her sleep in the igloo. And he said, no, Mom, I'm afraid that'd be a little too cold for my wife, but I can come up there, which he did. And they rounded up a few Canadians, and they had a little meeting up there for them. And the reason for that was that Sam had started it, and he was blind, and he had been keeping in touch with the New York office. And Sam couldn't see at all, but he believed in AA, and he got sober, and is sober to this day. And I was up in Canada last year, and Sam's wife came to greet me. And Sam was blind and had the flu and was not well and couldn't come, but he's been sober all these years. So imagine those sober Eskimos up there. There's just no limit to where this program goes and how it gets people well if they want to get well. I have more faith in Alcoholics Anonymous than I can begin to tell you. There are so many wonderful things that have happened. And then I found that life can get rough and that you don't have to drink. I had another bad experience where that I came home from the hole in the ground, which was the group that my brother Tex started. He came in Alcoholics Anonymous shortly after I did, and instead of going down and listening to the speakers at the mother group, he said, "Why, the drunks ought to have a chance to talk. I'm going to start a participation meeting." And here I am going downtown, you know, and I'm in charge of all the women that got sober. They're my babies. And Tex is starting this group out there in Huntington Park, and the powers that be downtown are saying, "What's your brother up to?" And I say, "Well, he's starting a group out here in Huntington Park." "Well, he can't do that." "Well, he has." "Well, he can't do that. We've incorporated Alcoholics Anonymous in California. That means nobody can start a group unless they have our permission." And so Tex went down there, and they bawled him out, and they said, "We don't want you here, sir. You came down here a few times and caught on how to do it, and now you've started to rival group out there in Huntington Park." And he said, "It's not a rival group." He said, "It's just we got so tired of driving so far from Long Beach clear on down to the Friday night meeting, we just thought we'd start one halfway, and then on Wednesday nights, we meet at Curly O'Neill's house down in Long Beach, and that gives us one on Wednesdays, one on Mondays, and one on Fridays, see?" And they said, "No, we don't see." Now, our attorney has incorporated Alcoholics Anonymous of California. And if you don't fold that group up, we'll sue you. We'll run you out of town because you are hurting this group, and it will cause all kinds of problems for us. And so we have incorporated Alcoholics Anonymous worldwide. Nobody can start a group unless, you know, the New York office, and we give them the okay. And Tex sat down and laughed, and he said, "You have tried to incorporate Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't care if the member here that's an attorney has incorporated it here in California. You can't do that. You might as well try to incorporate a sunset. I'll lay you 8 to 5 that within a year or two we'll have groups around here and here and here and San Bernardino and Chino and Oxnard and everywhere else. I'll guarantee you that this thing is going to grow like wildfire and that no little peanut group of a mother group like you who refuses to let drunk in can stop it. It's going to grow." Well, he was right. We have grown, and we're growing faster all the time. And we're getting them younger and prettier and more handsome, and they gain their knowledge faster and faster because there's more books to be read, more knowledge to be gained. And then this thing that I talked about not too long ago and try to remember to say is that book, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, which I had laying around my house for a couple of years before I finally got around to reading it. It's about the anonymity thing. I read on page 264, somehow or other. Now, we're not going to correct it because we're pretty well settled in our ways now. We won't correct it. But Dr. Bob, I met him. He came out with Bill in the 50s, just the one time. And I got to shake his hand, and he was a very quiet man. Bill talked an hour at the Shrine Auditorium, and every AA in California was there. And shortly after, I hadn't been sober too long. And then Dr. Bob got up to talk, and he talked 20 minutes. And in 20 minutes, he said a lot. It was, every word was potent, powerful, powerful. And so when Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers came out, I finally found page 264 where Dr. Bob, and I could hear his voice, "Now, relative to that 11th tradition, which says that we're anonymous. It explains it. Anybody who can read the English language ought to understand exactly what it says and exactly what it means. It says that we're only anonymous at the level of press, radio, and film." Now, you know, he says, anybody in the second grade or better level of press, radio, and films. Because he said to be anonymous, and only give our first names and an initial, could kill people. He said, and these are my words now because I can't memorize the whole thing, but he said, suppose that I wanted to get hold of one of you because I needed to, for some reason, some good reason. And I would say, well, how will I get hold of Jack M? What does M stand for? Suppose a gal wanted to get in touch with Sybil A, B, C, D, E, F, D. I didn't know it was going to sound that way. And how would they do it? What kind of a telephone directory would carry the names of the people that can save our lives? And you'll find he didn't say it exactly in the words that I used just then, but that's the way it came out in my head, and it's good enough because it's the truth. And we have to be able to call each other in need, you know? Suppose that Tony, the Garcia family over here, was to drive me home. Baldy's going to drive me home. I don't know where Baldy is sitting. I'm going home tomorrow, and so Baldy from my home group in Pasadena is going to drive me home. God bless him. I love him. And honest to goodness, suppose that I wasn't able, in time of need, to call up Baldy or the Garcias or the Janes and the Susies and the Johns and all of you who are certainly willing to give me your full names. And I hope you do because I don't want to lose you. I don't want to forget this marvelous convention. I don't want to forget the faces, and I don't want to forget the names of the people because, I mean, you're my relatives in a sense. I need you a lot worse than you need me because you've done a beautiful job here in this at this convention. You've done a magnificent job. I can't ever remember ever having been so warmly welcomed and the friendliness that I have felt here. People of all ages, clear up to my age and down to the youngest person in the room. And I enjoyed it so much there going to the hole in the ground when my brother's group, before he died in 1952, he had been a heart patient for many years, and there wasn't anything to be done too much then for heart trouble. And it finally got to where he moved down to the hole in the ground, which is just the basement. That's why it's called the hole in the ground. We met upstairs on Sunday, which we called it the spiritual group. It was not, but that's Sunday night, or spiritual group. And we'd have a minister in now and then to enlighten us and give a nice talk. And Sunday night we could do that. And down at the hole in the ground, that was called the bucket of blood and all kinds of names until they landed it on the hole. Because on Sunday night at the participation meeting, Texas say, come on up here, Baldy, and let me hear from you. And Baldy would get up to talk, but he wasn't there, of course, but we'll say there was a Baldy that was there. And he would point. He'd say, now, like we said Thursday night, down at the hole in the ground, meaning the basement, and he would go ahead and relate something, see? Or they'd call on me to get up. And I'd say, yeah, I was down there at the hole in the ground last Thursday night, and Pete did say so-and-so. Well, that just caught on by accident. And that's why it was called the hole in the ground. And so I would go home from the hole in the ground, and I was married to Dick Maxwell then, the kindest man. He was the one that took me to my first meeting. But he never understood alcoholism. He came from a fine family who lived here in San Diego at 2552 First Avenue. And his aunt worked over in the scientific library there for many years, Alice Barlow. Her father was General Barlow. And he was a splendid, good man who adopted my Addie, her father. And he was a great man. And he had taken me to my first meeting when I was shaking so badly. And he stayed in there when they said the women have to leave. They thought he was the drunk, and he had a... He was dressed up and looked good, but he stayed in there and he came out shaking his head sadly and said, Bib, I don't know what they're up to. And he put up with it for quite a while. And I would come home and he'd be in the rocking chair in the living room, and I had this beautiful home and a housekeeper and everything was just fine. And honest to goodness, he'd be sitting there in the rocking chair with his chin jutted out, and he'd say to me, again? And I'd run over and put my head in his lap, just like I used to when I'd come home from a bar. And I'd say, yes, I did go to the hole in the ground tonight, Dick. And I promise you, I promise you, I will not go for a week. I promise you, I'll just be a good wife and mother. I will not go back for a week. And even to me, it sounded just like I used to talk when I came home from a bar, you know. But I couldn't keep away from the hole in the ground. And I would go back the next week, and I'd come home, and he'd say, the rocking chair, I can just hear it squeak. There he'd be sitting. He'd say, again, but you promised. And I'd go over and cry and wring my hands and say, oh, please, I know that. There's just something about it. I promised Susie that I'd meet her for dinner, and she had a problem, and I had one, and we shared this thing, and it was important to us. We don't want to drink. Well, he says, I tell you, I don't know how long I can put up with this. So I came home the following week, and he met me at the door, and he was all smiles. And he said, come in, honey. And I said, huh? I came from the meeting. And he said, come on, I've got good news. And I didn't know what it could be. And so I said, good news? Well, then let's go turn the lights on in the living room. It was one of those step-down living rooms. I didn't want to fall down and break my neck like I almost did tonight. And so we went in and turned on the lights, and he sat down in the rocking chair and looked very pleased with himself. And I said, what is it? What is it? And he said, well, I got to thinking. Now, you know what I want you to do? He said, I want you to go back to drinking like you did in the good old days, and I'll take care of you. I'll take good care of you, and you'll never hear a complaint from me about your drinking. He said, anything would be better than this. I could not believe I heard correctly. And I remember it just about, well, I was in a state of shock. I could not believe it. This good man, a well-intentioned man, a marvelous good, wasn't that bad after all. He says, anything would be better than this. Well, I was in a state of shock. And Addie wasn't there. She was either over in Catalina or she was married. I can't remember because, as I say, I was in a state of shock and I just couldn't hardly pull out of it. And I went out in the driveway where my new car was parked and I got in it and I drove off with whatever money I had in my pocket. I never cussed him or screamed or hollered or said yay or nay or anything else. And I left. And I went down to West Adams, and I'd driven down that street a million times, and it's where the big mansions had been turned into housekeeping rooms and flats and things of that nature, with a gas plate and a bed and a bathroom and like that. And so I rented a room for $7 a week, and I went down to the Times newspaper the next day and got a job on the Times. And I never looked back. And that's the way it was. And I'd take a streetcar to work. I never kept that car either. And I took a streetcar to work, and then I would take a streetcar out to the hole in the ground at night. And down at the corner, 300 yards on Figueroa, where the Automobile Club is on one corner in Los Angeles, there is a church, the Doheny Church. And every morning in my dim little housekeeping room, I would awaken to the bells ringing, ding-dong, ding-dong, the church bells ringing, and the tears would slip down my cheeks, and I just couldn't control it. I just couldn't bear it, really. And I'd go on to work and catch a streetcar out to the hole in the ground. And Christmas came, and I didn't have much of a Christmas. I went to the little corner grocery store, and I got a little tree about a foot high and put it on my dresser, and then I didn't have my heart in it, so I didn't even put any decorations on it. And I was very sad, but I didn't drink. And I would go out to the hole in the ground, and I'd talk to whoever was there, and I'd talk to anybody, and I'd go to the meetings, and I hurt bad. It was awful. It didn't ease up, really, honestly. It was just a sad time in my life. But it was an experience. It reminds me so much. It didn't last forever, of course. But what happened really was that my brother became quite ill, and he died in October of 1952. And at that time I was married to Jim Willis, the founder of Gamblers Anonymous, two blocks from the hole in the ground. We lived in this apartment. And Tommy Butler came running over to my house and said, Tex is gone. And I said, he's dead? And he said, in the kitchen. And that's the way it was. I went there, and my brother had suddenly had a heart attack, and he was dead there. And what did I do? I bolstered up the members and patted them on the shoulder, and I didn't shed a tear, and I was cool as a cucumber. And I never shed a tear, and I went to, so the fellows came down with a hole in the ground and said, with a hammer and nails, and I said, what are you going to do? And they said, we're going to nail up the door for a week out of respect to Tex. And I said, and where would the newcomer go? Where would I go? Where would you go? Do you think Tex would want you to shut the doors here for a week? Because of his death? You cannot do that. If you guys haven't got any guts, I'll lead your meeting tonight, which I did. And it nearly killed me. And I went home very defiantly, and I didn't cry. And I went down there every day and at night, and I would lead the meetings, and I didn't cry. And I began to feel very peculiar. And I certainly wasn't taking any stuff of any kind, didn't even know about it. Now, their pills weren't floating around, they might have been, but, I mean, there wasn't any thought of pills or anything like that. It was just the thing I had to do. I had to do it. Numb. I know now. But I didn't then. It was very real to me, you know. And I finally knew that this was not the way it ought to be, that I ought to go and be hugged and kissed and just bellow and cry. And I didn't feel like crying. And so I thought, well, who can I tell? I can't tell them. And so I wrote a letter to Bill Wilson. I found her. Bill had been out here several times to see how his groups were doing, and he had talked to us, and he had corresponded with Tex. Tex went back to Bedford Hills and spent Christmas with Bill and Lloyd one year. And I thought, why didn't I think of this sooner? I'll tell him about it. And so I wrote this pitiful letter to Bill Wilson at Bedford Hills, and I got an answer immediately. I've got it at home with the plastic paper over it now because it's faded with the years. And he said, "Dear Sib, your letter has moved me more than anything in recent years." He said, "I too love Tex very dearly." But he said, "In God's house there are many mansions. And somehow or other I see your brother Tex sitting on the porch of one of those mansions talking to another drunk in the sunlight. And that's as it should be. And so much for Tex. But as for you, my dear, I will tell you this, that life is but a long day in school. Some of our lessons are hard. Some of our lessons are easy. It's really not so much what happens to us here, but it's what we do with the experiences we have. It's the demonstration that counts. Love, Bill." And I read it, and I read it again, and I read it again, and there was a burst of tears. That saved my life. It saved my life. And I would read it again and again. And so finally I began to think about when I'd see one of our members who would have a similar experience, some tragedy, you know, hard to bear. And I read it. "Please feel free to do so," or words to that effect. And that was the conclusion of his letter, ever devoted to Bill. And so I have found people who needed to hear something like that, and I have had many, many hundreds, maybe thousands of those Xerox and given them or mailed them to people who had had a bad experience. It was a bit much. And it's strange that a seemingly small thing, a beautifully written letter, but with so much love and compassion, and it really and truly saved my life. And it's one of the reasons that I'm here tonight, so terribly grateful. A 79-year-old woman, 46 years sober, but with life's tribulations here and there, and sometimes just joyous and great, and sometimes I'm petty and small, and I've improved in some departments, and maybe not the great improvements that so many of you seem to have made in a shorter time. And I'm not an especially good person. I never intend to be bad, but I've got a long way to go, but I know how to do that. It's to go with you. Thank you. I love you.
It's my pleasure, Ghost, that carries this label. And the label she carries is the first lady in AA on the West Coast. Her name is Sybil, and she's from Los Angeles, and let's welcome her.
Thank you, Darrell. And thanks to the committee. Everyone on the committee has been terribly good to me, including Darrell. And I'm always so amazed and so surprised that I should get any attention at all, because I'm just like you. I mean, I drank in very poor bars and rotten bootlegging stuff and got drunk and had to be hauled home. And now I get called the oldest woman west of the Rockies or something like that. And you know, and I know that at my age and after my experience in AA and having been sober and hugged and kissed and loved as much as this, that if I got drunk now, it would kill me. Kill me right away. I wouldn't even linger around very long. Because next month I'll be 79 years old. Last month, I celebrated my 46th sober birthday, a heartbeat at a time. I wonder how that must sound for the young members. I'm talking about age, the 15, 16, 18, 20, 25-year-old kids, young people who come in now, and they see Grandma Moses up here, you know. And they'll think, well, my gosh, you know, it's just not possible to ever, you know, live to be that old and not have a drink in 46 years. Yeah, it's possible, but it doesn't mean that it's always just moonlight and roses and untold wealth and good health and make a lot of money and always look good to the people and say the right things and nothing bad can ever happen to you because you don't drink now. And then I look around and think about my mother and my father. They never did drink. And they never had any good times particularly. So here I am, supposed to be a little unique, I suppose, because I've hung around so long. But I intend to be here for a long time. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that must be the Oxnard table there. I think I see the Garcias. And I'll tell you about the Garcias. I was married to a compulsive gambler. And that's the part of my long name of Sybil Doris Adams Stratton Hart Maxwell Willis Corwin. And when it got to the Willis part, my daughter Addie, who came down especially to be here from Northern California, is laughing. She's been sober 5 years, five miraculous years, Addie Williams. And she was laughing about Jim Willis, who started the gambling, non-gambling program, Gamblers Anonymous, so successfully, as her stepfather, or the two steps. I've kind of forgotten how many steps there were packed on that. They were terribly fond of each other, and he was a great man. And these people from Oxnard, in his last year, he spent in a rest home a block from their home, the Garcias. And do you know the Tony and Tony trudged over there every day of people before today, Addie, that they lived there in Oxnard. They knew what a wonderful thing that he had done for so many gamblers that killed themselves and literally cut their throats because there was no way out. And he wrote the book and he did the meeting directory and he traveled around the country and got GA started all over the country and did a great job. And the Garcias sitting right here had no idea. I thought they'd be invisible out there someplace. So thank you again for meaning so much in our lives. It is so helpful to have people who stick by you when the going is rough. Because as human beings, you know, the human beings all over the world have rough times and they don't have to get drunk at it or take dope for it and all of that kind of thing. But we've had people stand by us and looking back over your lives regardless of your sobriety date, it's a great thing to know that actually that most of us are closer to each other than we are our first cousins, perhaps. Some of us would say mother-in-laws. Others would name distant relatives or the neighbors next door. And yet you know what makes me tick, and I know something about what makes you tick. And I found out early on that if Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work when things got tough, that it wasn't worth a plugged nickel when the sun was shining. It had to work through everything, no matter what. And it does. I don't know where that guy is sitting that I gave a hug 25 days sober because of the light so I could identify you. And I talked to him and hugged him 10 minutes before the meeting started. And 25 days sober, can you imagine that? What must he think of us when we shout and scream and hoop and holler with laughter one moment? And then we get deadly serious when we talk about this alcoholism thing and what it did to our lives. Because it is a serious thing, and most of us who come to AA know that there's absolutely no other way out but this, permanently, except in a few cases, a religion, but not in the majority of cases. Because a lot of us tried religion first. We tried drying out places. We tried lots of things. Tried willpower, that dirty word. Willpower. That's all I ever tried was promises, promises, I won't do it again. I won't be missing for 3 days. I really won't ever drink again. I swear I won't. I promise you I won't. I really mean it. I mean it. I mean it. I'd rather die than drink again. Well, I meant that. But there I was. The longest time I ever stayed sober was 9 days when I hitchhiked out of town with Addie's father, Bill Hart. He was a sailor boy, paid off out of the Navy, didn't have a nickel. And we got married, and Addie was born, and my mother took care of the baby. And when she was 6 months old, we were dead broke, and we hitchhiked out of town and left Addie there with my mother, who was very ill with a heart problem, heart trouble, and died. We hitchhiked hungover and depressed and poor and didn't want to behave the way we were doing. And we got out as far as Arvin, which is 18 miles this side of Bakersfield in California. Got over the ridge route all right, which was just a muddy trail then. It wasn't a big thoroughfare. And it took us a long time hitching rides on trucks and things to get there. But when we got to where it said Bakersfield, 18 miles or 25 miles, whichever it was, there was a little sign pointed to the right that Arvin. And we got a cold drink or something there. We slept in a haystack that night. I'd forgotten about that. And the next morning, the man at the little grocery store there where we got some crackers or something to eat, he said, if you want to hitchhike into Arvin, they're picking grapes there, and I think they can use you. So we walked and hitched rides on a little truck full of grapes and one thing and another till we got to Arvin and got a job picking grapes. And the sun was hot, 120 or something like that, and I was sweating. I was very young, and I thought, this is the life. Now I'm away from those drunks and those places and those saloons, and now then I won't have to drink anymore, and Mama will take good care of the baby, and we'll make a little bundle of money here picking these grapes, and when we go back, well, we'll take the baby, and we'll rent the apartment, and I'll have my little girl, and she'll never see her mother drunk. And I worked hard, and I was dirty and sweaty, but happy. And then along about sundown, all of those grape pickers had come from many directions, and they were college kids mostly that were there to earn tuition for the fall. A nice, clean-cut little crowd. And they gathered around and built a bonfire because there wasn't anything else to do except getting their sleeping bag or whatever. And so they built this bonfire, and they started harmonizing. And Bill and I joined the little crowd there, and I thought, now this is the life. Oh, boy, will I be healthy and tan, and I'll be such a good wife and mother when we get back to Los Angeles. And we started harmonizing with them. And then I saw around this big circle of young people, and Bill here and I'm here, I saw a bottle start being passed around the circle, a bottle being passed, and I knew what it was. It was a big, big quart of whiskey. And I knew, and my mouth began to water. I was salivated, and I knew that when that bottle reached me, I watched for the next. I thought, God, I hope there's enough for me. And it finally reached me, and I turned up the bottle and drank the rest of it, the whole thing. And realizing that I had failed once again, I couldn't bear it. I got up from the campfire, and I wandered down the row of grapes, stumbling from one row to the next, just stumbling along with my head down and sobbing and crying. I remember looking up at the moon and praying, oh, God, why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? And I never felt such sorrow. My throat just ached from pain. And I finally began to worry and got terribly frightened because I heard this heavenly music in the answer to my prayer. And it was heavenly. It was eerie. And I thought, all right, I've overdone it this time. Now I've got VTs. I've got VTs on top of everything else. Listen to that music. It's so beautiful. And I began to stumble and run to get away from the music, and I couldn't get away from it. It got louder and louder and louder. And so pretty soon I stumbled upon this big khaki tent out there in an acre that was free of grapevines, and it was the local revival meeting, a church meeting. And all of the townspeople were in there singing hymns, but I didn't know that. And when I reached there, like those double doors there, I parted the flap of the tent, and the music stopped. And the preacher, he was disconcerted, and he looked back in the back to where the exit was, at this dirty face, tears running down my cheeks, this woman standing back there swaying back and forth. And the congregation slowly turned around and gave me the eye. And as he was saying this, if there are any among you who want to be saved, please come forward at this time, which was the cue for the regulars to do this thing, you know. But I was the one who wanted to be saved, and they were really interested in my behavior. And so I staggered and lurched, and they mentally were helping me along, I suppose. And it took me forever and a day to get down there, and they began to sing "Just As I Am" without one plea, and it just nearly killed me in the tears. And I finally got to the altar, and the preacher put his hand out and put it on my head to pray for me, and I threw up all over it. Now, in later years, I did many bad things, especially driving a car. But I never had anything or never heard any story as disgraceful as mine that I threw up on the preacher because I couldn't bear what I had done. And boy, did I get out of there and hitchhike back to that, to get on the main road to Los Angeles. And a truck came along and stopped, and I got on the truck, and the truck driver felt sorry for me. Everybody seemed to feel sorry for me in those days. Poor little thing, poor little thing. And so I got on the truck, and he took me to my mother's door. He heard my sad story, and there was Mama taking care of Daddy the best that she could. And that was just one little tale out of my youthful past. I was so young. And would vigorously deny it to everybody that, well, I didn't do anything. I was very defiant. Don't tell me what to do. And yet I'd go and just suffer. And do it again. And then when I would get in my car and lurch off down to the beaches someplace and get terribly drunk and terribly sick and hide my bottle in the sand at a beach party where the others were behaving themselves and toasting weenies or something, I would have my bottle of sand where I could haul it out and get drunk, and they'd wonder, well, where'd she get all that stuff anyway? They didn't have any to speak of. And I just misbehaved terribly. And so then I got in the car in my wet bathing suit, and I started back towards Los Angeles, and the squad car beamed their lights at me, and I had been terribly sick all over my bathing suit on the front seat of the car, and I was just, make it home, kill me. And the squad car stopped, and I looked so bad that instead of throwing me in jail like they do these days, they said, we're going to follow you, lady, get going and drive slowly. And they followed me, and I began to straighten up a little bit, and then they got ahead of me and said, follow us, and they took me to my door because I'd given them my name and address. Now, they don't do that these days. They do not. You know that. And so I must have been a pitiful sight, but they felt sorry for that poor little thing, and they shouldn't have, because on the other hand, if I was in a different mood and I was in a bar, if somebody said something I didn't like, I'd clobber them, I'd hit them, I'd get thrown out in 86. Don't come back here anymore. And there were a lot of bars I couldn't go in because I always started to fight and wind up out in the side walk just yelling and screaming and being crazy. One time when I left the bar, I left before 2:00, and I only lived 2 blocks from this car, this bar, and I was at the stage to where that I knew I'd make it home all right, but I would have to run a little bit and fall down. And I'd get up and I'd run a little bit and I'd fall down. And I'd run a little bit and lay there a little while. I'd get up and I'd run, make a good little run of it, and then I would fall down. And I kept this up for 2 blocks, and when I got to our house where Addie was cozily sleeping with the housekeeper now to take care of her because I couldn't, we just had hired her, dear Mrs. Stevens, who was with us then for quite a while. And I would run, and I would stumble, and I would get up, and I'd go. And I got to our steps, and as I went up the steps, I looked back, and my nylons were off and trailing down the steps, and only my foot was in the heel of the nylon. And I had been trailing those in back of me all the way from the bar. And I didn't feel very happy about all that. And yet I would pray. I'd pray for help. Oh, God, please don't let me behave like this. What's wrong? I can't bear it. And so one day I got in my car very depressed, and I drove up over that ridge route and went to San Francisco and got there daylight and looked around and barely daylight, and there wasn't even any place to get a drink, and I wondered why I am here. I don't know anyone. I want to go home. I turned around and I got back on the ridge route, and not very prosperous days then, and the fellow who looked like he wasn't such a bad guy raised his hand for a ride, as they will do, and I pulled over because I could drive no longer. I was exhausted. I wanted to get home and see Addie, and so finally he got in the car, and I said, can you drive? He said, yeah. And I said, I have to have some sleep, and take me to Los Angeles. And he says, that's where I'm going. And so I got in the back seat and went to sleep. And finally, somebody was shaking me. Lady, wake up. We're in Los Angeles. Here we are at 6th and Hill. I'm going to leave you here because I have to go down to Skid Row. That's where I belong. He said, you're here at 6th and Hill. Can you hear me? And I said, yeah. And so he left. And I looked to see where I was at 6th and Hill, and my eyes were blurred, and I read the sign there. It said, Sultan Turkish Bath. And I thought, I was pudgy in those days. Real, my face was very full, my arms were pretty big, my legs were big, my body was not that large, but I was out of proportion. And I thought, I'll take a Turkish bath like I used to when my brothers teased me, and I would take off 5 pounds real quick with a Turkish bath before I put it back on in a week. And I thought, that's that place where I used to take those baths. I'll go in there and sober up, and I'll go home, and I'll look good. And then I can tell them that that I went up to San Jose to look at a prune ranch that was a good buy, and I was in the real estate business then, and that's why I was out of town, and I can cook up the story, and the housekeeper will believe it, and I can get my foot in the door one more time, because Dick had said he wouldn't put up with it. And so I didn't want to go down there and think. I wanted to turn my head off, and I looked at them at the newsstand there. How handy. I wanted something to read after the Turkish bath, which takes quite a while. And I would stay there all night, and the next morning I would put on my makeup, go home and wouldn't have the shakes, and I'd be okay, and I wouldn't get in any worse trouble than I was in. So I thought, I'll read, and I just grabbed the magazine. I had my Turkish bath, and then the terrible thoughts began to come back, and I was laying there in that cot in the little booth, and the light was shining down in my face, so I picked up the magazine just to read anything. And it was the Saturday Evening Post, and it was dated March 1st, 1941. And down at the high, it said Alcoholics Anonymous by Jack Alexander. March 1st issue, 1941. My God. And so I opened it, and with goose pimples coming out, because I had picked up a Time magazine with an article in it by Fulton Ausler 2 years before that, in 1939, when I was at my mother-in-law's home, a saintly lady. 2 years before, I had picked it up in Liberty Magazine, now defunct, of course. But there was a short article in there that said, Alcoholics and God. And I had read that, and he had written his first piece about Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was very short. And he simply said there was a small band of men who were meeting regularly and banding together who were alcoholics who did not want to drink. And so they met weekly and discussed their experiences, and they called themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, I'll go back there. I'll find them. I will do that. And I couldn't wait to get out. I just couldn't wait. I looked at the pictures, you see, and I turned, it was a full-page photo. And there were two men, and they were sitting by a bed. And I thought, oh, they're in a hospital. That man's awfully sick. He's probably as sick as I am. And there were these men there, and I thought, mentally, see, I didn't read the article, just looked at the pictures, because I knew about AA, having seen it in Liberty. And so I thought, he's awfully sick, and they're there in the AA hospital where they cure him. Just as real as if it would work, you know. And I turned the page, and then there was this guy in the ambulance at first. The first picture showed him in an ambulance, and that was very interesting. I mentally thought it had AA hospital on it, you know. That they'd wheel him off to that. And then I turned the page, and there they were talking to him in the bed there, and I thought, oh, that's where they cure him, you know, and I was gonna, and then I turned to the end of the article to see where to find them, and I thought, I'll take the next plane back there. And so I got the box number, I don't know what it was then, but we'll say box 1345 or whatever, Grand Central Station, New York. And I wrote a letter to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, I'm a woman alcoholic, and I'm at the point of death from drinking, and I can do no better. And I have a lovely home and a good family, and I have a little girl, and I can't make it at all. I cannot make it at all. What can I do? I must enter your AA hospital and get cured. Please tell me where you are, and I will be there as soon as possible. And I gave them my address and phone number and everything, and I went on home and got my foot in the door one more time, and I waited for an answer, and it came right away. Airmail. And it was from Ruth Hawk. God bless her. She was Bill Wilson's secretary then, a little 25-year-old girl who worked for Bill, free, because he had no money. He gave her stock in Alcoholics Anonymous is what he did. That's what they did. They laughed about it later, but that's really what happened. And so my answer came, and she said, I'll never forget her handwriting. I'll never forget her signature, rather. Ruth Hawk. I can see it now. And The letter is not too long, but it simply said, Dear Sybil, we were glad to hear from you. You need not come back here to find Alcoholics Anonymous because in December 19, 1939, they started Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles, your own hometown. And we will say this, there are very few of them. I started with two men and one man actually finding another, and then they joined together. But we understand now that they're meeting in the Elks Temple in Los Angeles and no longer meeting in homes in Pasadena. So I will give you the telephone number and address of the man who appears to be, leading the group, or he has started the group or helped with it in some way, because he's the only one we correspond with at this time. And so she gave me Frank Randall's address at 532 South Coronado and his phone number. And so I went ahead and got drunk first. And because she had, unfortunately for me, had added a P.S. at the bottom of the letter. If you need help immediately, call Cliff Walker at Crestview 12345, whatever it was. Cliff Walker. And the name, I will get tears if I even talk about him, because he really saved my life. I got drunk in this bar and I got thrown out. And then I remembered AA, and I got out the phone number of Cliff, which was Crestview something or other then, and called him up, and his sleepy voice answered, and I said, Send your AA ambulance and pick me up. I'm ready. And he said, we don't do that. What kind of an outfit are you anyway? I got drunk, and you should have called me before you got drunk. I said, well, he said, we have a meeting downtown. I don't go because I'm a milkman, and I'm ready to leave the house now and settle for milk. You should have gone to the meeting Friday night. The meeting's been over for hours. Why didn't you go? And I said, I did, but they threw me out. Oh, he said, that's impossible. That's impossible. They wouldn't have done that. They would have been so happy to have you. He said, you know, we've never had a woman alcoholic. We've never had a woman alcoholic. We understand that there is one in New York who is... they don't know how it will work out with her, but her name is Marty Mann. But we've never had a woman alcoholic. There has never been, except that one back there, that we don't know what her record is. So, actually, I couldn't do it anyway, but I'll give you Frank Randall's phone number. And I said, yeah, but they did throw me out. And he said, oh, there's been some mistake. They thought you were a wife. There was no Al-Anon. And any wife who came with her husband brought her knitting or something, I guess, and Frank would make this announcement. I'm jumping ahead to tell you what he would say. He'd say, this is the regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in California. We're a bunch of ex-drunks who've gathered together to obtain and maintain our sobriety on an all-time basis with no mental reservations whatsoever. And I would sit there shivering and shaking and say, what an order. I can't go through with this. Who could? I mean, all-time basis with no mental reservations whatsoever. But that's what happened. He said, go down there and tell him that I'm going to get in touch with him and tell him that there was an unfortunate mistake today, that we now have a woman alcoholic on the West Coast as well as Marty Mann on the East Coast. And so the following Friday, I did go down, and I was really shaking and nervous. And I don't know why I had the nerve to do it after what I thought had happened to me, but he tried to make me... feel comfortable. And so when I went back, I had this red turban on and bloodshot eyes, and my face was just a mess. And if the dresses were long, then I wore them short. If they were short, I wore them long. I was always behind and everything. And so I sat there just palpitating and scared witless. But Frank was, he was so eloquent. He was talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and his story about getting drunk in Phoenix, Arizona and everything. And now then, before we get into talking to you alcoholics so that you can talk, we're going to ask the women to leave the room. He said, except if there are any here who will call themselves alcoholic, those women may remain. And he looked right at me. So I grinned and I folded my arms and I stayed, and the wives got up and left, and they had their own special type of little Al-Anon meeting out there, I guess. And I stayed, and so I remain, and from that day to this. And as I say, it's been glorious, it's been wonderful, and then I've had my share of problems and illnesses in the family and all of those things that happen to everybody all over the world, whether they ever had a drink or not. It seems to me that one of the greatest experiences that I can remember ever having, and I should talk a little bit about it, is that let me get a bearing on the clock here so that I won't be charged with talking too long. I was the executive secretary of the central office in Los Angeles for 12 years. And I want to tell you that I finally got an apartment four blocks away from the office. And I always loved animals, so I had a little dog, a little fox terrier, Tippy. And I would walk him in the mornings before I went down to the office. And I got an apartment a block away from 1805 Wilshire Boulevard, where the central office was. And I would walk into a park, which was about four blocks away from the central office, every morning. And so one morning, I took him down, and I was walking around, and there was a tree in the center of the park, and under it was a man with a newspaper. He was sitting down with his feet out. And as the dog and I were walking past him, he would move the newspaper so that we couldn't see him. That was his little home there under the tree, and he just made himself invisible to the lady that walked the dog every morning. And I never got to see what his face looked like. And then one time when I walked the dog at night through the park, and it was safe in those days, he was lying down with a newspaper over his face. And I watched his deterioration. And I felt ashamed. And I thought, here you've become a professional AA, answering the telephones at the central office and sending other people out to work with the alcoholics. And yet you've been watching this man now for a week, and here he is on the ground. And I took the dog back and looked under the tree. It must have been a willow tree of some kind. It came down almost to the ground all the way around. And I looked under there, and he was stretched out straight and not moving. And I thought, oh, I've waited too long. He's dead. I've waited too long. And so I bent over him, and I hollered, Mister! No answer. Mister! No answer. And I never could arouse him. And I thought, I waited, oh, I'm a rotten person. So I went to the corner liquor store, and I got a scrap of paper and asked him for a pencil and a pen or something, or anything, a scotch tape. And I wrote a little note, and I said, I'll be back at 6 a.m. in the morning to see you. Stay where you are at all costs. And I somehow pinned it to his shirt and went on home. And so the next morning, I left the dog at home, and I went back to see the man, and I tiptoed under the tree, and he was propped up under it, and he said, oh, lady, I woke up, when I came home last night, I found your little note and was laying on the ground. I guess you thought you had put it on my body, but I thought it was a note of some kind, but my glasses, I usually hang them up on the tree at night when I come home. I've been staying here a long time, but they're not there now, so I couldn't read it. So I took it to the liquor store, and the man said, you get back under that tree, and you stay there till that lady comes back. So he says, now you got me, lady. What are you going to do with me? And I said, you'll see. So I put him in the car, and I took him down to the 12-step house, and I told him to look after him, and which they did. And pretty soon, one morning, he comes into the central office where I'm working. It wasn't long after that either, and he looked. I didn't recognize the man. They'd given him clothes. And he said, little lady, he said, you know, I'm kind of deaf, and that's why I couldn't hear you very well that night when you tried to talk to me under the tree. And he says, I'm awful hard of hearing. And he said, one of the members down there at the 12-step house, his wife had died, and he gave me a hearing aid. I'm here now. I can hear you if you want to talk to me. And he said, you know, they made me cook down there at that 12-step house. And I was that was my profession. I was a cook before my drinking got so bad. So he said, I don't plan on drinking anymore. And I go to the meetings around the area here, and especially at the 12-step house. So I don't intend to drink. And he said, I want to give you a buck for you to put in the kitty here for somebody like me that might come along and need help as bad as I did that night. And so he said, I'll come back and see you pretty often. It's only about four or five blocks from here, which he did. And he never had another drink. He looked sharp in a $50 suit long after that. I kept track of him forever and a day. And it made me feel good to see what would be considered a helpless, hopeless person in every aspect turn out just to be a solid citizen. And then one time, I was sitting there at the central office answering the phone, and a girl's voice said, can you help me? And I said, that's what we're here for. And she began to cry. And she said, I don't know what, sitting down here in this Skid Row hotel room, and there's about 11 winos lined up against the wall asleep, and their jugs are all over the floor. And I'm so hungover and sick, and I just don't know what to do. And I said, well, we can't help 11 winos passed out down on Skid Row. She said, well, I know that, but what about me? What about me? Can you help me? And I said, well, of course, that's a different story, but I won't send a woman down there alone. I said, will you not drink until I can get someone down there? It might be several hours. I'll get on the phones right away, which I did. And I got Bill Welch and his wife, who were both AA members, and they went down there on Skid Row and found the exact situation the way it was. And I called up B at the Friendly House and told her that this gal begged for help, that she was a helpless Skid Row wino, and would she take her in? And B said, send her over to me, baby, send her over to me. And then I called Happy Austin, who was a go-getter, and I said, can you round up some clothes for a gal who wants to get sober and not what she doesn't want to drink? Happy said, you can count on me. And it just turned out fine. Well, the thing was that her husband and son and this woman had all got separated because of her boozing. And her husband had been an upstanding citizen, and her son was in a home somewhere out in El Monte, and she didn't know how to find him. And anyway, B investigated around and found out where the ex-husband was. And so this girl developed pneumonia, and it was Christmas time. And she developed some kind of pneumonia that drugs get, and she died. And it was my job then to notify the son and the husband, and they came, but they didn't know. The son was never told that his mother was in that shape. It was just that she lived there with those beautiful women at Friendly House and had been doing fine when she caught pneumonia. And he never knew. He was just a fine-looking boy, about 15. And so Happy Austin called every woman alcoholic she could lay hands on to be there to make a funeral out of it. And when we got out there, I want to tell you, there was a crowd of people, men and women, standing around there making out that they were friends of this woman who died so suddenly. And that made you feel good when you knew that his mother had this terrible problem. And it didn't hurt him not to know at that particular time. If he was told later when he was a man, why, I'm sure he took it very well indeed. But this alcoholism thing is such a killer. And it is so hard to peg. And there's not too many people who really understand what it's all about. Our neighbors down the street certainly don't. Maybe they think they do now because they've been enlightened and they've read a lot. But they never know until they themselves, if they're alcoholic and want help and need help, and when they recognize that and come here and find the welcome that this man with 25 days will find that he has, what a wonderful big family it is. It's just like one big family. I'm not afraid of you anymore. I don't feel like I don't belong. I feel like I'm at home. I would be at home anywhere, in any land. Whether they could speak English or not, it wouldn't make any difference. Honest to goodness, Bob went up to Inuvik in Northwest Territories to talk a few years back because they had nothing up there but igloos. And they said, when they phoned him and told him to come, they said, you being civil, and we'll make her sleep in the igloo. And he said, no, Mom, I'm afraid that'd be a little too cold for my wife, but I can come up there, which he did. And they rounded up a few Canadians, and they had a little meeting up there for them. And the reason for that was that Sam had started it, and he was blind, and he had been keeping in touch with the New York office. And Sam couldn't see at all, but he believed in AA, and he got sober, and is sober to this day. And I was up in Canada last year, and Sam's wife came to greet me. And Sam was blind and had the flu and was not well and couldn't come, but he's been sober all these years. So imagine those sober Eskimos up there. There's just no limit to where this program goes and how it gets people well if they want to get well. I have more faith in Alcoholics Anonymous than I can begin to tell you. There are so many wonderful things that have happened. And then I found that life can get rough and that you don't have to drink. I had another bad experience where that I came home from the hole in the ground, which was the group that my brother Tex started. He came in Alcoholics Anonymous shortly after I did, and instead of going down and listening to the speakers at the mother group, he said, why, the drunks ought to have a chance to talk. I'm going to start a participation meeting. And here I am going downtown, you know, and I'm in charge of all the women that got sober. They're my babies. And Ketch is starting this group out there at the, in Huntington Park, and the powers that be downtown are saying, what's your brother up to? And I'll say, well, he's starting a group out here in Huntington Park. Well, he can't do that. Well, he has. Well, he can't do that. We've incorporated Alcoholics Anonymous in California. That means nobody can start a group unless they have our permission. And so Tex went down there, and they bawled him out, and they said, we don't want you here, sir. You came down here a few times and caught on how to do it, and now you've started a rival group out there in Huntington Park. And he said, it's not a rival group. He said, it's just we got so tired of driving so far from Long Beach clear on down to the Friday night meeting, we just thought we'd start one halfway, and then on Wednesday night, we meet at Curly O'Neill's house down in Long Beach, and that gives us one on Wednesdays, one on Mondays, and one on Fridays, see? And they said, no, we don't see. Now, our attorney has incorporated Alcoholics Anonymous of California, and if you don't fold that group up, we'll sue you, we'll run you out of town, because you are hurting this group, and it will cause all kinds of problems for us. And so we have incorporated Alcoholics Anonymous worldwide. Nobody can start a group unless, you know, the New York office, and we give them the okay. And Tex sat down and laughed, and he said, you have tried to incorporate Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't care if the member here that's an attorney has incorporated it here in California. You can't do that. You might as well try to incorporate a sunset. I'll lay you 8 to 5 that within a year or two we'll have groups around here and here and here and San Bernardino and Chino and Oxnard and everywhere else. I'll guarantee that this thing is going to grow like wildfire and that no little peanut group of a mother group like you who refuses to let drunks in can stop it. It's going to grow. Well, he was right. We have grown and we're growing faster all the time. And we're getting them younger and prettier and more handsome and they... They gain their knowledge faster and faster because there's more books to be read, more knowledge to be gained. And then this thing that I talked about not too long ago and try to remember to say is that book, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, which I had laying around my house for a couple of years before I finally got around to reading it. It's about the anonymity thing. I read on page 264... Somehow or other, now we're not going to correct it because we're pretty well settled in our ways now. We won't correct it. But Dr. Bob, I met him. He came out with Bill in the 50s, just the one time. And I got to shake his hand, and he was a very quiet man. Bill talked an hour at the Shrine Auditorium, and every AA in California was there. And shortly after, I hadn't been sober too long. And then Dr. Bob got up to talk, and he talked 20 minutes. And in 20 minutes... He said a lot. It was, every word was potent, powerful, powerful. And so when Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers came out, I finally found page 264 where Dr. Bob, and I could hear his voice. Now, relative to that 11th tradition, which says that we're anonymous, it explains it. Anybody who can read the English language ought to understand exactly what it says and exactly what it means. It says that we're only anonymous at the level of press, radio, and film. Now, you know, he says, anybody in the second grade or better that can read, understand that we're only anonymous at the level of press, radio, and films. Because he said to be anonymous and only give our first names and an initial is... could kill people. He said, and these are my words now because I can't memorize the whole thing, but he said, suppose that I wanted to get hold of one of you because I needed to for some reason, some good reason. And I would say, well, how will I get hold of Jack M? What does M stand for? Suppose a gal wanted to get in touch with Sybil A, B, C, D, E, F, D. I didn't know it was going to sound that way. And how would they do it? What kind of a telephone directory would carry the names of the people that can save our lives? And you'll find he didn't say it exactly in the words that I used just then, but that's the way it came out in my head, and it's good enough because it's the truth. And we have to be able to call each other in need, you know? Suppose that Tony, the Garcia family over here, was to drive me home. Baldy's going to drive me home. I don't know where Baldy is sitting. I'm going home tomorrow, and so Baldy from my home group in Pasadena is going to drive me home. God bless him. I love him. And honest to goodness, suppose that I wasn't able, in time of need, to call up Baldy or the Garcias or the Janes and the Susies and the Johns and all of you who are certainly willing to give me your full names. And I hope you do, because I don't want to lose you. I don't want to forget this marvelous convention. I don't want to forget the faces, and I don't want to forget the names of the people, because, I mean, you're my relatives, in a sense. I need you a lot worse than you need me, because you've done a beautiful job here in this at this convention. You've done a magnificent job. I can't ever remember ever having been so warmly welcomed and the friendliness that I have felt here. People of all ages, clear up to my age and down to the youngest person in the room. And I enjoyed it so much there, going to the hole in the ground when my brother's group, before he died in 1952, he had been a heart patient for many years, and there wasn't anything to be done too much then for heart trouble. And it finally got to where he moved down to the hole in the ground, which is just the basement. That's why it's called the hole in the ground. We met upstairs on Sunday, which we called it the spiritual group. It was not, but that's Sunday night, a spiritual group. And we'd have a minister in now and then to enlighten us and give a nice talk. And Sunday night we could do that. And down at the hole in the ground, that was called the bucket of blood and all kinds of names until they landed it on the hole. Because on Sunday night at the participation meeting, Texas say, come on up here, Baldy, and let me hear from you. And Baldy would get up to talk, but he wasn't there, of course, but we'll say there was a Baldy that was there. And he would point. He'd say, now, like we said Thursday night, down at the hole in the ground, meaning the basement, and he would go ahead and relate something, see? Or they'd call on me to get up. And I'd say, yeah, I was down there at the hole in the ground last Thursday night, and Pete did say so-and-so. Well, that just caught on by accident. And that's why it was called the hole in the ground. And so I would go home from the hole in the ground, and I was married to Dick Maxwell then, the kindest man. He was the one that took me to my first meeting. But he never understood alcoholism. He came from a fine family who lived here in San Diego at 2552 First Avenue. And his aunt worked over in the scientific library there for many years, Alice Barlow. Her father was General Barlow. And he was a splendid, good man who adopted my Addie, her father. And he was a great man. And he had taken me to my first meeting when I was shaking so badly. And he stayed in there when they said the women have to leave. They thought he was the drunk, and he had a... He was dressed up and looked good, but he stayed in there and he came out shaking his head sadly and said, Sib, I don't know what they're up to. And he put up with it for quite a while. And I would come home and he'd be in the rocking chair in the living room, and I had this beautiful home and a housekeeper and everything was just fine. Chair with his chin jutted out. And he'd say to me, again? And I'd run over and put my head in his lap, just like I used to when I'd come home from a bar. And I'd say, yes, I did go to the hole in the ground tonight, Dick. And I promise you, I will not go for a week. I promise you, I'll just be a good wife and mother. I will not go back for a week. And even to me, it sounded just like I used to talk when I came home from a bar, you know. But I couldn't keep away from the hole in the ground. And I would go back the next week, and I'd come home, and he'd say, the rocking chair, I can just hear it squeak. There he'd be sitting. He'd say, again, but you promised. And I'd go over and cry and wring my hands and say, oh, please, I know that. There's just something about it. I promised Susie that I'd meet her for dinner, and she had a problem, and I had one, and we shared this thing, and it was important to us. We don't want to drink. Well, he says, I tell you, I don't know how long I can put up with this. So I came home the following week, and he met me at the door, and he was all smiles. And he said, come in, honey. And I said, huh? I came from the meeting. And he said, come on, I've got good news. And I didn't know what it could be. And so I said, good news. Well, then let's go turn the lights on in the living room. It was one of those step-down living rooms. I didn't want to fall down and break my neck like I almost did tonight. And so we went in and turned on the lights, and he sat down in the rocking chair and looked very pleased with himself. And I said, what is it? And he said, well, I got to thinking. Now, you know what I want you to do? He said, I want you to go back to drinking like you did in the good old days, and I'll take care of you. I'll take good care of you, and you'll never hear a complaint from me about your drinking. He said, anything would be better than this. I could not believe I heard correctly. And I remember it just about, well, I was in a state of shock. I could not believe it. This good man, well-intentioned man, a marvelous, good citizen. He said, and I'll take care of you like I did in the good old days. He says, it wasn't that bad, after all. He says, anything would be better than this. Well, I was in a state of shock. And Addie wasn't there. She was either over in Catalina or she was married. I can't remember because, as I say, I was in a state of shock and I just couldn't hardly pull out of it. And I went out in the driveway where my new car was parked and I got in it and I drove off with whatever money I had in my pocket. I never cussed him or screamed or hollered or said yay or nay or anything else. And I left. And I went down to West Adams, and I'd driven down that street a million times, and it's where the big mansions had been turned into housekeeping rooms and flats and things of that nature, with a gas plate and a bed and a bathroom and like that. And so I rented a room for $7 a week, and I went down to the Times newspaper the next day and got a job on the Times. And I never looked back. And that's the way it was. And I'd take a streetcar to work. I never kept that car either. And I took a streetcar to work, and then I would take the streetcar out to the hole in the ground at night. And down at the corner, 300 yards on Figueroa, where the Automobile Club is on one corner in Los Angeles, there is a church, the Doheny Church. And every morning in my dim little housekeeping room, I would awaken to the bells ringing, ding-dong, ding-dong, the church bells ringing, and the tears would slip down my cheeks, and I just couldn't control it. I just couldn't bear it, really. And I'd go on to work and catch a streetcar out to the hole in the ground. And Christmas came, and I didn't have much of a Christmas. I went to the little corner grocery store, and I got a little tree about a foot high and put it on my dresser, and then I didn't have my heart in it, so I didn't even put any decorations on it. And I was very sad. But I didn't drink. And I would go out to the hole in the ground, and I'd talk to whoever was there, and I'd talk to anybody, and I'd go to the meetings, and I hurt bad. It was awful. It didn't ease up, really, honestly. It was just a sad time in my life. But it was an experience, and it reminds me so much. It didn't last forever, of course, but what happened really was that my brother became quite ill, and he died in October of 1952, and at that time I was married to Jim Willis, the founder of Gamma, lived in this apartment, and Tommy Butler came running over to my house and said, Tex is gone, and I said, he's dead, and he said, in the kitchen, and that's the way it was. I went there, and my brother had suddenly had a heart attack, and he was dead there. And what did I do? I bolstered up the members and patted them on the shoulder, and I didn't shed a tear, and I was cool as a cucumber. And I never shed a tear, and I went to so the fellows came down to the hole in the ground and said, with a hammer and nails, and I said, what are you going to do? And they said, we're going to nail up the door for a week out of respect to Tex. And I said, and where would the newcomer go? Where would I go? Where would you go? Do you think Tex would want you to shut the doors here for a week? Because of his death? You cannot do that. If you guys haven't got any guts, I'll lead your meeting tonight, which I did. And it nearly killed me. And I went home very defiantly, and I didn't cry. And I went down there every day and at night, and I would lead the meetings, and I didn't cry. And I began to feel very peculiar. And I certainly wasn't taking any stuff of any kind, didn't even know about it. Now, their pills weren't floating around, they might have been, but, I mean, there wasn't any thought of pills or anything like that. It was just the thing I had to do. I had to do it. Numb, numb, numb. I can't explain it. It was a terrible illness on my part, I know now. But I didn't then. It was very real to me, you know. And I finally knew that this was not the way it ought to be, that I ought to go and be hugged and kissed and just bellow and cry. And I didn't feel like crying. And so I thought, well, who can I tell? I can't tell them. And so I wrote a letter to Bill Wilson, our founder. Bill had been out here several times to see how his groups were doing, and he had talked to us, and he had corresponded with Tex. Tex went back to Bedford Hills and spent Christmas with Bill and Lois one year. And I thought, why didn't I think of this sooner? I'll tell him about it. And so I wrote this pitiful letter to Bill Wilson at Bedford Hills, and I got an answer immediately. I've got it at home. with the plastic paper over it now because it's faded with the years. And he said, "Dear Sib, your letter has moved me more than anything in recent years." He said, "I too love Tex very dearly." But he said, "In God's house there are many mansions. And somehow or other I see your brother Tex sitting on the porch of one of those mansions talking to another drunk in the sunlight. And that's as it should be. And so much for Tex. But as for you, my dear, I will tell you this, that life is but a long day in school. Some of our lessons are hard. Some of our lessons are easy. It's really not so much what happens to us here, but it's what we do with the experiences we have. It's the demonstration that counts. Love, Bill." And I read it, and I read it again, and I read it again, and there was a burst of tears. That saved my life. It saved my life. And I would read it again and again. And to think about when I'd see one of our members who would have a similar experience, some tragedy, you know, hard to bear. And I would ask them if they'd like to have a copy, because he said, "If you like what I have said, my dear, and you wish to share it, please feel free to do so," or words to that effect. And that was the conclusion of his letter, ever devoted to Bill. And so I have found people who needed to hear something like that, and I have had many, many hundreds, maybe thousands of those Xerox and given them or mailed them to people who had had a bad experience. It was a bit much. And it's strange that a seemingly small thing, a beautifully written letter, but with so much love, truly saved my life. And it's one of the reasons that I'm here tonight, so terribly grateful. A 79-year-old woman, 46 years sober, but with life tribulations here and there, and sometimes just joyous and great, and sometimes I'm petty and small, and I've improved in some departments, and maybe not the great improvements that so many of you seem to have made in a shorter time,